This is a production of Cornell University.
March 9, 2009, GPSA meeting.
Okay, we're going to bring the meeting to order at 6:02. So, first off, welcome.
Thanks for coming. Mario is out of town this week, or at least the start of this week, and so I'll be chairing the meeting today. Thanks for being flexible. There was a speaker earlier. Luckily, it finished up early, so we were able to kind of get things moved in and settled. But I hope that maybe this new casual setup will lead to greater discussion, and I welcome everybody. I mean, in the past, we've kind of had these separate rows, and people have been behind others, and I hope nobody has ever felt excluded for that reason. I mean, this is a meeting for discussion, and I welcome everybody to speak up. We'll have some things to talk about and discuss today. So, with that, I want to welcome a couple guests who will be speaking with us later. Ryan Lavin is the president of the Student Assembly, and Josh Myrick is the councilman for the city of Ithaca for the fourth ward, which is College Town, essentially. So Ed Trone is one of our council reps and also one of our UA reps and our College Town Neighborhood Council reps. The three of them will be talking later on in the meeting. So now we'll move on to open forum. This is the time where anybody can bring up items that are not on the agenda. Right.
First, the Big Red Barn is looking for future program managers or operation managers. So if you are interested in either of those positions, you can contact Chris at the Big Red Barn. I don't know what the pay is. You'll have to talk to her about that, but they're looking for, you know, someone that's going to be here more than 1 year. And the second announcement is on April 3rd, that's a Friday, the officers from SAGES, the Geneva Student Association, will be coming down to Ithaca, so we'll be hosting them that night. If you care to join us, we'll be taking them to TGIF if you want to meet them, and then dinner to follow. So as we get closer to that day, we'll send out one.
Any other items for open forum? Mike.
The Board of Trustees met in Ithaca on Thursday and Friday, and if you haven't read this important email to the Cornell community, I suggest you read it at some point. We basically outlined some of the actions that we took, which included the approval of the university taking out $500 million, $500 million in taxable debt, and basically that money is going to be used to cover some of the working expenses, working capital over the next couple of years to deal with the current economic climate right now, to basically take the place of funds that would have gone to endowment and funds that have not come in either from the state or other sources as well. So if you have any questions about how that's all been working out or any specific concerns, let me know.
Any other items for open forum? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on to executive updates. I just have a couple of things, two things that I want to mention. First off, we've been talking a lot about graduate and professional student housing this year. So one thing that we have been working toward is trying to keep graduate housing communities for graduate and professional students and essentially keeping undergraduates out to maintain comfortable living situations for both populations. One way that we, the GPSA, compromised in that is we suggested that perhaps Schuyler House be converted gradually to undergraduate housing in order to consolidate graduate and professional students. Now, basically try to have supply meet demand, right? Find that equilibrium point. So we made that suggestion to Campus Life, and we continue to work with Campus Life on that, and they are taking us up on that. And so next year, Schuyler House will be predominantly undergraduate. The graduate students who are living there and who have requested to continue living there have been fully notified and have been given options to move out of Schuyler House to another graduate residence. but they also have the option to stay there if they wish. So I'm just bringing that here to keep you all informed and updated on that. So we continue to work with campus life. Again, this is one of those things, it's been exacerbated because of the economic situation. So, you know, while it was a difficult situation to begin with, now it's made even worse because campus life is not going to allow any beds to go vacant next year. That is a source of revenue, and basically they're mandated by the Board of Trustees to give undergraduate and transfer students housing. I mean, that's kind of a broad generalization, but there are certain populations, if they register by certain dates, they're guaranteed housing. So campus life has certain obligations they have to fulfill. Are there any questions on that? Right. So, I'm sorry.
Is that the same situation that we're talking about?
So, Hasbrook, what we're trying to do is we're working to maintain it for graduate professional students, hence kind of keeping by giving up the guidelines. But that being said, enrollment admissions are down because of the economic situation, and continued occupancy at Hasbrook is also down. So, I mean, the numbers are kind of stacked against us, and it could be that undergraduates are put at risk. We are trying. We're trying. I mean, campus life is working with us. They've been very cooperative. But I guess I feel like we have to cooperate with them. It's one of those situations where I feel like they have our best intentions at heart, and given that, I am willing to cooperate with them. And I think it's being. Communication is out there. I think information is out there. I think they're pretty transparent, unlike what happened a few years ago when things were not transparent. So for that, I'm grateful.
Are there still an abundance of contracts open at Hasbro?
I don't know. Laura, do you have any numbers? So Laura is one of the managers.
Yeah.
I don't know your exact number.
I'm one of the graduate resident managers. Specifically, I work with our Skylar House and with I don't have official numbers as compared to the last time I met a month ago when Barbara Mono and Joe Burke were here. I do know that the new option where we have a two-bedroom townhouse where two unrelated people can choose to share that space, we have gotten some success with that, and there are people who have been interested and signed up, but we're currently matching the two positions together. But again, anything you guys can do to continue to support the efforts and recommend, obviously that's really helpful because we really do want to help support graduate students' needs and keep those spaces graduate as well. And if anyone ever has any questions, you're always free to contact myself or my colleague, graduate residence manager, who works with our Hasbro and Kirsten and Hughes properties, Kirsten Bosniak. So I'll be here after if anyone wants.
Comments or questions on that? Okay. A couple other things. So everybody probably hopefully everybody received an email saying that there's going to be a transition in our listserv. We apologize if there's some confusion in this. But this body, if you now write to gpsa-core-members@assembly.cornell.edu, it will go to everybody. So, and everybody in this group should be on there, all right? If you find that you're not receiving GPSA emails, then let me know, and we'll get it to you, okay? All right. And the final update is, like Mike said, the Board of Trustees was in town last week, and I gave an address as representative of the GPSA, and I thought it went well. So, one of those things, it's kind of an intimidating crowd, but it's always an honor, and it's an honor to represent the GPSA and graduate and professional students here. You all work very well, very hard, and very well together, and I appreciate that, and I recognize all of you, and you got a round of applause in the middle of my speech. It was kind of, I was surprised.
Yeah.
They all interrupted with a round of applause when I said, that I want to thank all of my GPSA members. Anyway, sorry.
Michelle did a good job. She made me look bad, actually. She did so well.
All right, so moving on. Deandra, do you have anything to update us on?
Well, I just wanted to say thanks, everybody, for committee reports. So last time we met, I mentioned that I was having a little bit of difficulty getting the list straightened out. And so hopefully I will see many reports last month. So I'm hoping that if you are a committee representative, if you have not received a report in front of you, please come see me and I'll get it straightened out. Otherwise, thank you so much. And that's all.
Okay. And one update from Mario. Last business meeting, we passed a resolution on Martin Luther King Day and voicing an opinion that the GPSA supports having Martin Luther King Day as a university holiday. So since at the beginning of the semester, we were asked to talk about the academic calendar in response to the fall semester. This would be something in response to the spring semester, which the Faculty Senate is not looking into. But according to the Dean of the Faculty, Bill Fry, they will be doing a more comprehensive look at the academic calendar, and they'll be taking our resolution into consideration. All right, so we will move on. If there are no other questions, move on to committee reports. All right, let's start with Brian. Advocacy.
Okay, so our committee met last month to discuss further the upcoming town hall meeting. That is going to be held on Monday, March 30th, at the Big Red Barn from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Kate has the flyer, and that will be sent out through Facebook, email, the core listserv, and anywhere and everywhere else. So if you could please, when that comes to you, if you could post that in your respective departments, that would be good. In addition, we do need help with preparing posters that are going to be hanging at the town hall meeting. We need help with tabling. If you're interested in helping us in any way, we really do need your help. If you could contact me, my email is dmf34. Again, any help that you could give us would be greatly appreciated. Besides the town hall, the other things we have going, advocacy is scheduling a meeting with Gannett to talk about graduate mental health. So at a previous meeting, I think I discussed that the Assembly passed a resolution asking for a committee to be formed to look at specifically graduate and professional student mental health and welfare. We have not had that meeting yet. We're still trying to get everyone's schedules together so we can have that meeting. So as soon as we get anything from that, we'll let you know. On the topic of mental health, at the next core meeting, we will be having representatives from the group EARS. I can't remember what they stand for.
Empathy.
Yes, thank you. EARS will be coming to speak to the core at the next meeting and discuss their new graduate initiative program that they started this semester. Two more things, and then I'm done. First is, at the last core meeting, you'll remember Greg from CIT came and did a presentation about the transfer of email accounts from what we have now to either Google or Microsoft. Student Advocacy contacted Greg and is going to be working with that group with reviewing their documents and also the mock site that they'll have before it goes out to the students. So it's our way of having the GPSA have an input on this transfer. Last thing is, I had a meeting with Sharon Dittman from Gannett a few weeks ago. Something that we're going to advocacy is going to start pushing is their patient advocacy program. They do have a program. Should you have any concerns or problems with Gannett, that you can contact them. So because of that, student advocacy is going to try to promote that program with them. So that should be coming out soon on our website. And
great.
Okay. Questions, comments? Cool. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
Kate. Hey, everybody. So this Thursday, Felicia, grad night out. It'd be great if you can forward the email that I sent. Yes, I just have a few updates about the situation with the Finance Commission where we were trying to approve new funding guidelines. You all, if you were here last month's meeting, you probably remember the skit that Jürgen put on with some assistance from the rest of us. And I'm happy to say that those funding changes that Jürgen and I were proposing, along with the Funding Policy Commission and the Finance Commission, passed unanimously at the business meeting of the month. And so what that basically means for you is that there's a lot of funding changes for student groups that are applying for funding from the GPSA. And especially for all of you, it means that if your field has a organization such as like your graduate student organization or something like that, that applies for funds, the rules for applying for funds for those organizations are quite different now than they were 2 weeks ago. So we're coming up on the season where you apply for your annual budget, so where your graduate student association is going to put in a request for how much money they want for all their activities for next year. So two ways to become informed about the new regulations that are out there are, one, you can go to the GPSAFC website and read the 13-page new document, which it's not that long, as it's not as bad as it sounds, but that's one way to become familiarized with the process. And another way is that this Thursday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. in 304 Furno Hall, we are having a workshop for all officers of clubs that want to come and learn about the new funding guidelines, or maybe not even necessarily the new funding guidelines, just learn about how the GPSA funds student organizations. So at 6 to 7 p.m. in 304 Furno Hall. So if you know any officers, presidents, or treasurers, particularly of student organizations, or particularly, I guess the emphasis is on the field organization, please have them come to that meeting, or if they have questions, they can email me, DTE6, the net ID. So.
This Thursday?
Can
you send a little
email reminder? Sure, I'll send it to the core email list. And so you can have, I'll send you the information on the place that it's at and who we're targeting to hopefully attend. And, all right, Ben.
Should that email also go to DGFs or whoever we're trying to get more representatives?
It's already been sent out through the Student Activities Office to all registered presidents and treasurers of organizations, but another email is another email, so I thought maybe this forum would be great and that we could get however many people hear word of mouth out as well, if you do know some leaders for student leaders of organizations.
I was mostly thinking if there are fields that don't have representatives here that we're trying to recruit, mm-hmm. we need to make sure they know somehow as well.
That's very true. I'll send an email to the DGF then. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, you could probably do that through Brenda.
Through Brenda, yeah.
Any other questions? On to the last committee report, the Ad Hoc Charter Committee.
So you're probably tired of hearing from Preston and I at this point, but we really need to be emphatic that you read the changes that we discussed. Right now, the big changes that are on the table that we really need input from you are the name changes and then the new committee form. So with the name change, what's come out of the committee, one of the things that the committee wanted to do was make it more clearly defined what the core does and what the assembly does, and how those functions and how it's defined in our charter. And the suggestion that came out of committee right now is that we change it to the Graduate Professional Student Association, and then under that have the assembly and the core. So there are two bodies under one umbrella, per se. And then the other suggestion that has come forward here in the last week or so is that instead of changing the name, we still have the Graduate Professional Student Assembly, but instead we have voting members and non-voting members. What is currently the core would be non-voting members, and what is currently the assembly would be voting members.
Would those people be also called representatives?
That I'm not sure of, because it's a suggestion that's been sent forward. We'd really like to hear some feedback on that, because right now there's there's some hesitation to go either way on either suggestion. One involves a name change in logistics university-wise, and one to some people doesn't seem to be as clear. And so there's really a double-edged sword there. And so, and I'm trying to be fair and accurately represent how these come forward. So we, if you have some feedback on that, we'd really like to hear that. I'll give you the other couple, and then Preston can either take the floor and add stuff, or you can provide suggestions on that. The other one is the creation of the internal policy and procedures committee, which their basic function every year is to make sure that the bylaws are looked at and evaluated before the academic year starts, so after the new assembly is elected in the spring and before the academic year starts, and then every other year to do a charter review. Because one thing that came out of a committee was that the charter review process needs to be a little bit more systematic instead of, and somebody needs to have some responsibility for knowing the charter and knowing the bylaws. Some of the discussions that have gone around on this is the creation of another committee, a committee chair, and filling said committee. Because, as you know, we already have problems as an assembly as a whole filling our committee and filling our committee chair position. The way it's set up now is that the chair of this committee will either be the council of the assembly or someone who is elected from the assembly as a whole. The other suggestion that's out there is to put this back under the vice president for operations and just make it much, much, much more explicit that this is their duty to follow through. And then the third one is a change of the funding policy committee to the appropriations policy committee. This was suggested because a lot of people tend to confuse the finance commission with the funding policy committee, and this became apparent during byline funding years when both of these committees tend to have fairly distinct different and some people think that it should stay the same, others believe that it should change. And part of the reason I'm bringing these up is that our charter has to be passed by 2/3 vote of the assembly. And these changes also affect core members here as well. And these are some pretty big changes in the organization. So we're trying to be due diligence in these offers. Other than that, there hasn't been any contention on separating out the finance documents, at least as we know of yet. and if you get snippy emails back from Preston and I apologize, we're a little sick of the charter at this point. Any feedback that you have on these major issues, again, being the organization change, or name change, committee addition, and then the SPC.
Can you clarify how the second suggestion for the change in assembly from non-voting to voting members is uniquely different from what we currently have?
How it's uniquely different from what we currently have. I'm not sure how this would be constructed. Mike,
I think I was one of the people who made the suggestion, and you're absolutely right. I think with it, there's very little change, except for we're simplifying the names. I think a lot of confusion has come in the past. It's this acronym of CORE. You know, it sounds like it's the CORE body. And this whole separate body that kind of meets in tandem with the GPSA. And then we have the assembly members who are kind of thought of as members. It's very vague how it's currently written in our charter. So the idea is to consolidate the two. Everybody is a representative of appeal somewhere. And some of those people now have the privilege to vote on resolutions, vote on the charter changes, vote on motions. Vote in the whole term of property sense. And then there are people who have basically the same level of speaking privileges as everybody else. And those are what's called the non-voting members. We probably need to think of, you know, some decent names, better names maybe for these people rather than voting and non-voting. We're still working out the ideas. But basically, the, you know, we're still going to have one business meeting and one discussion meeting a month. And I think that's something that we're all pretty much on the same page of, just like we have in the past. And we're going to have these, you know, two different levels of membership. But they're all going to be members of the assembly. They're all going to have the same speaking power. It's just 19 of them will have voting power.
Right. We've already, even without the name changing business, clarifying how they are in the charter. And so right now, where we're at is how we define whether we actually change the name to the GPSA and then have to graduate professional students association and then have assembly core, keeping the same name that we tend to use in tandem now anyway, or to simplify it in this way of having just the assembly and then having the voting and non-voting, whatever name ends up coming out there, in which simplicity tends to work. Any other comments? Yeah.
I was going to say, it seems to me that I very much enjoy the suggestion of not using the word association. It seems to me that that sort of, it introduces another level. We have the, I mean, I can just remember, we have the employee assembly, we have the student assembly, and we have the office of assembly. And then the faculty senate, you know, wants to do their own thing, but I don't think we need that level of ostentation. I think it would be a good idea to stay with this sort of lexicon in which, if we're a member of the Office of Assembly, you know, to stay with the term assembly. I'm not entirely familiar with the discussion that occurred within your committee.
Well, within the committee itself, I would say half of the members were surprised to find out we were called the Graduate Professional Student Assembly. A few of us were under the notion that we were actually called the association to begin with. And I think that comes in from biases of different schools that have come in from, because of the fact that GPSAs in other countries are labeled either assembly or association. I don't know the history of the organization. Is the assembly generally viewed as a separate body from the core, or sort of an executive group within the core?
Well, how it's written now in our charter, there are two things, how it's written and how it tends to function. So how it's written in the charter is that the core elects its executive body to speak on behalf of all the graduate students. And it's somewhat structured the same in how the new charter comes to court. And Creston, correct me if I'm representing this wrong, in the old charter, it goes on, it mentions the core early on, and then it goes on to talk entirely about the assembly. It doesn't really give the definition of what the core is or does, or it's somewhat amorphous. And then, so one of the clarifying things that we really wanted to do was to make this definition change, to function how we function now, where you have the core that's elected from their field, however field decides to elect or appoint the representative, and then that body elects this voting body, which then has the executive and does a lot of the representation on the university side of things with administration.
Any other comments? I'd like to make a few comments. I mean, I usually, as the chairperson, would try to remain unbiased, but I think there's some really important things that are going on here, and I mean, I've been involved in the GPSA since 2003, so I think that I have a little bit of history behind me to speak on some of this. And in those years, the GPSA has gained a lot of clout with the administration, and I think it's because we've spoken up on the things that are really important, but we have been cooperative on those things where we feel like we can be cooperative. And the administration appreciates that, and I think they will be all the more appreciative of that kind of cooperation given the economic climate. They want to see assemblies come forward on the things that really matter. And as Amy said, we vote on this, two-thirds of the assembly has to approve, but also President Thornton has to approve on this. And at a time like this, President Thornton has a lot of things that he needs to take care of. And I think going through some name changes is not really what he needs to be taking care of right now. I don't support changing it to Graduate and Professional Students Association. I support keeping it as assembly. I think, as Nighthawk said, it shows a cooperative effort with the other assemblies. I feel like there are simple ways to get over the definitions of who we are and what role that we serve. If that means just simply saying we're a voting member or a non-voting member, maybe that's it. Maybe it's some other solution. But also, I think one of the things that makes it unclear is that as people get involved in the GPSA, they don't take the time to read documents. And that's okay. I'm not saying that every one of you should be reading the full charter. I know that everybody is very busy. But at the same time, it is there for clarification if you have questions. And certainly, the officers, we're here if you need clarification on things. In terms of one of the other major changes of the Internal Policy and Procedures Committee, I don't know if I'm necessarily in support of that for reasons that Amy said. Sometimes it's very difficult to get enough people to serve as committee chairs, and this would be creating another committee. So I think it would be reasonable to put this under the Operations and Staffing Committee, which is chaired by the Vice President of Operations. And given that person's role, the BPO serves on the executive team, so that person has direct ties to administrators to talk about charter changes. And since many of these charter changes have to be approved by administrators, that puts that person right in line with administrators. And then finally, changing the FPC to Appropriations Policy Committee. I mean, this is another one of those name changes where I feel like I don't know if it necessarily needs to be done. I feel like there's general confusion because we have two treasurers, essentially. I feel like that's what the confusion is. I don't necessarily think that changing a name will clear up that confusion because we're still going to have two treasurers. But again, these sorts of things can be cleared up by reading the charter or just asking what somebody should do. So that's more than 2 cents, but that's what I have.
Some of the feedback, just to kind of address some of what Michelle, because all this stuff came out of the committee and most of it was unanimous, in fact. One of the things in terms of the Internal Policy and Procedures Committee was that we didn't necessarily want, right now the way it's written is the Operations and Staffing Committee basically goes away after they appoint committee members. Because these are all committee chairs of other things, and they're busy and things like that, and what they were doing. And we talked around actually putting the charter in both the BPO or leaving it as a separate position if somebody wanted to take that responsibility on. And what came out of there is that people would rather have the BPO worrying about committee chairs than necessarily being forced to do the charter revision. That it could be a choice that they took this on, but that they wouldn't be forced to do this.
I don't think it would be a forced thing because they would choose.
Well, but there are two different things. There's the committee side, and then there's the charter side. And it was kind of like where the BPO used to be the assembly, university assembly member. And had to take on that position as well, and we took that out. And so there's somewhat of that responsibility. And I don't know if Deandra wants to speak to this, being this year's CPO, and things like that. But one of the things, in any case, with the naming change that the committee felt was that it had to be clarified, because half the people that come into this body have no idea what the core does or what the core means. Even if there's a document out there in reference that you can think, okay, what the heck am I doing? to define some clarifying purpose. And if that requires some, I mean, we changed the content. Right now, we're disagreeing on the need.
So, Amy, I see there's one more comment. I want to, we have time for night final comment, and then we need to move on because I want to try to keep us on time.
Just on the point of the name change, it's not clear to me why the suggestion that Mike elaborated on, I'm not sure, it's not clear to me how that doesn't take care of the naming problem. Because I think if the name McCorr was removed altogether, at least on face, it seems to me that would be one way to address the naming problem, because then everyone realized the members of the same association, the same assembly, or the same grouping of people. And I think that might actually be beneficial in terms of making us realize that the core, what is currently the core and what is currently the voting body of the assembly, are actually one body, and we should be looking to each other for support, and that we're not two separate entities, that we should be relying on each other for feedback, that, you know, at the core we should be talking about some of the things that are deliberated on in the assembly, because it's important to receive feedback of those members. And so I think maybe that would be even more beneficial in bridging the groups.
So I'm going to leave it at that. If you have any other comments, if things come to you later on, feel free to email Preston, Amy, myself, whoever. We're in communication about this, and it will be discussed at future meetings. So feel free to send it to future meetings as well. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Ed, Ryan, and Sean.
I'll pass this around. There's not very many of these. About one for every third person. It's not incredibly informative, but that acts as a reference. So, you guys probably all got my email, maybe didn't suffer through the whole 3 pages of it. But basically, the city, along with Cornell, identified that College Town needed sort of a master plan, an urban plan, that it's been left to its own devices for too long. The city recognizes that it's a huge economic engine for the city. And Cornell administratively doorstepped the campus. For students, it's obviously a really important hub for living and for social life. So the city put together a group of people which represented undergraduates, graduate students, property owners, business owners, local residents, to basically identify some of the issues in College Town and put some aims together as where College Town could go forward. Then the city got together, and Cornell and the city jointly hired a consulting firm as an outside source of expertise to go through, gather input, look at the numbers, and work with this group of individuals representative of diverse people with interest in College Town, and put together a set of plans to suggest that the city take legislative action for it. I served as one of the graduate students, Devante as common council member and also undergraduate. Kate Duke was the undergraduate president. We met as students with the consulting group. I gathered a number of graduate students. There were some undergrad. We told them our concerns. They met with local residents. And so we worked continually over well over a year with this consulting firm, putting quite a lot of effort. Pretty much everything was on the table. Everything from, you know what, I've got a good idea now, to rent control, to all kinds of different things. And what came back is this huge document, which I personally think represents a really good direction. The first thing that became really apparent is that the value of College Town is tremendous. It's surprising many people how much College Town is worth. The land, the amount of revenue that goes through College Town, specifically that core area where there's now 60-foot buildings. The price per acre there equals what it costs for downtown San Diego. So it's extremely expensive, which means there's a lot of money to be made there, and then, you know, it radiates outwards. It dwarfs the rest of it, basically. So you can see the study area basically is what we think is College Town. College Ave, Dryden, Stewart, and Eddy, and then some points in the street. And so that was the study design area. And so I'll mention a number of the concerns, sort of the big concerns, were that College Town is basically vibrant 9 months out of the year, and in the summertime the undergrads leave, and this is a struggle. The rents are so expensive that losing revenue during those months really hurts businesses. The point of neighborhoods are a considerably different design. They're, you know, largely long-term residents and families that now see students looking for places to live, which are starting to migrate into those neighborhoods. And they want to be quote-unquote protective neighborhoods and keep them residential areas of that nature. Students, meanwhile, are looking for quality living. They want to live in College Town, same thing with graduate students. I mean, many of us don't live in College Town, but when I talk to graduate students, there just would be an interest if it were an attractive place for graduate students to live. And grad students are especially a good population. Now, we're students, we'll pay some premium prices to live next to campus, and we're here for many years, 12 months out of the year. And professional students take some time off in the summer to get elsewhere, but most of us stay here. So what worked out is that in order to protect those adjacent neighborhoods, basically you have to accommodate the number of students who want to live in College Town. And at the end of the day, the choice is either you increase the footprint of College Town or you increase the density at the current footprint that you build up. But there's a number of ways to do that. And if you have this, basically the idea is that a lot of those buildings are old. And the reason why they're old is that it's so expensive to build and to buy property in College Town if somebody wants to cause a new development, that current landowners who already have their property largely paid off, if not completely paid off, having the motivation to sell. You cash it out for them. The amount of money that a new developer can make at the cost of buying something isn't really attractive to new development. So you need to sort of create economics, ignoring you as fast as economics most. So you increase density, you infill, notably, like if you're familiar with the long drive and the more sort of smaller apartment buildings on Dryden, there's a lot of sort of behind the building, there's lots of parking space. The sides of buildings have a number of feet on each side of the building. There's more urban ways of doing to satisfy density. A great example is actually on Dryden at that Five Corners point, there's that modern building. That's a nice example of an attractive, doesn't really stick out, but it's a very efficient space. And so the plan suggests basically that this is a direction the city needs to encourage, but sets out very clear architectural styles that you need to be consistent. You can't build an ultra-modern building. That you should have these architectural designs which make it consistent and blend in well. And then I showed just a couple examples from other locations, what that might look like. Talking about density. The core is worth a ton of money. And undergraduates especially really want to live in that center area. I would live there too if I could afford it. So how do you then concentrate some density there? And as far as graduates go, if undergrad concentrates towards the denser part of College Town, then that frees up the flanking edges, which remain in the older style with yard. And that's something that's attractive to graduates, to have some sort of yard with the family to live there. So if the population moves towards the center, that frees up pressure on the edges, and we can get some grad students to move in. Especially areas along Eddy and Stewart have been identified as prime locations that Cornell can work with developers to look at how
Is there any concern at all that if you, with this renovation, it will increase the property values further? And for instance, I live on Stewart, and it's quite affordable as you get closer to 79.
Yes.
But is there any fear that as those property values continue to rise, perhaps an accelerated rate because of this, it will push the rent up and maybe force me to move out?
So it was...
Right, students do have limited money.
Yeah, that was brought up. It's a delicate balance, and I'm by no means an expert in real estate. It is a delicate balance, but I think the idea is that these things aren't going to change overnight. This is simply trying to find a modern set of tools that College Town can go by, but that as more things are built, and the Santa Core will probably assuredly fill up fast than the flanking edges. And we're not talking about profit margins that are off the charts. It became clear that it's going to be local development, because in order to attract mass really build this project, they need a greater than 8% return, and that's just not possible.
Well, what I'm afraid of is that you could get the sentence, in 10 years,
yeah.
the graduate percentage population on Stewart Avenue will be 50% less than it is today. That's the sort of sentence that I'm afraid of hearing.
See, we're predicting that that will happen because the current situation in Oshkosh right now, we have an unnaturally low vacancy. An unhealthily low vacancy rate. That's why rents are kind of there. Very captive audience. You can't go too far from the campus. And not too many units to survive. So while you are going to get investment, that may force land values up because more people invest, you'll also be seeing more units, which would force landlords to actually compete over students that are excluded from being a landlord. So you may see land values rise, but we predict that rents will stay about the same as more people spend money. Also competing with other
landlords.
Clearly, it's very difficult to draw in businesses and developers for a neighborhood that's virtually closed for 25% of the year. The numbers that you're quoting here, the prices, are they for the residential areas, like the large apartment complexes, or are they for the commercial zones or spaces? And along that line, is it still profitable for, I've heard over the years when talking about the underdevelopment or the vacancies in college towns, I've heard many times that the rents are very high, not just for people to live there, but for businesses to move in there and these sort of things. Is it still profitable for the landlords, or how is it still profitable for the landlords to have the rents be so high if such a large percentage of the commercial zones in College Town are vacant?
And I can, so I think you'll find a large amount of the storefronts that are vacant are actually all owned by the same guy. And he has a history of, if anybody knows what I'm talking about, he's got a history of being unreasonable and a little irrational. Plus, he's also got such deep pockets that he has no meaning to budget. I mean, this guy doesn't even live in the area. He's got land all over the world, literally. So when we complain to him, he's leaving the storefront empty on Dryden Road, and he's serving the military college town, but he doesn't want it. So land values, the way they do land values is actually Hopkins County assesses the land value. And they don't care what's on the land currently. They care who's making money from the land and how much. So you could have a single family living right next door to a 100-person apartment complex, and they will say, well, this 100-person apartment complex is bringing in $1 million a year. That makes your, and they have a lot of land similar to your lot of land, that makes your lot of land worth $1 million a year. So right at the core, you'll find between $8 and $10 million per acre, and as it goes out, it gets down progressively. I think on the graph it shows, and the outer residential district.
One of the things that concerns me is similar to what Jay said, is that grad students already build a space in college town. And if the rents in these space similar to what they are now, you're not going to attract graduate students into college town anymore. I personally ran into this in terms of campus services for students last year, because I didn't live where typical undergraduates live, because my perspective on how much you should pay for rent is different than it is for most graduate students. They all tend to live in commons or out by the mall or places farther away. And unless you get rent going lower than they are now, or even in 10 years being what they are now, you're not going to get graduate students in there. And then the other thing is that I noticed in the proposal reading that Ned said before is parking. If you don't keep parking for graduate students there, because the hours and places that graduate students tend to have to go versus those of undergraduates tend to be very different. And parking tends to be a much more important issue.
I noticed the same thing, which is over email, and he gave me an answer. So
I've spoken a number of times to exactly what you're saying, that at the end of the day, grad students can live far away. But somebody like, and I'll use myself as an example, the reason why I got involved is I'm willing to pay the premium to live in a and that's what undergrads are willing to pay the premium to live this campus. So like I said, you know, everything was on the table, and things were talked about. So the areas that have been identified for grad students are those swing areas. And there were, originally we started out as maybe grad students to look at the lower half of Linden, the edge of Dryden, Eddy Street, and Stewart. Big swaths, amazing, yes, mention all of those for grad students. But in all frankness and honesty, College Town is going to be dominant. That's what it's going to be. The goal is to give as many graduate students who are willing to pay that premium the opportunity to find a residence that they would enjoy. And that's one thing that is supply and demand. When you increase the supply, you concentrate people in the core. You're going to relieve the demand. The property owners are going to have to compete with each other. And I do think it will be beneficial. Looking at like rent control or rent subsidies, was mentioned, it was basically determined to be a no gain. It wasn't going to go for it. As far as parking goes, this plan has a tremendous amount of transportation. Transportation is a huge problem in College Town on many fronts. And the plan does actually suggest allowing landlords to build fewer parking spaces in College Town. The flip side of this is that basically they'll pay into a fund which will support, say, if landlords can pay into a fund, cities might want to clarify this, open up the garage downtown for some people to put cars in, which a lot of undergrads don't use their cars very often. And if, in many cases, people bring cars because, like, I'm renting this apartment, it comes with a parking space, but a parking space will put a car. But now, if you say, look, every apartment doesn't come with a parking space, you don't get a parking space, you have to actually pay what that parking space costs. And in the core, that's a ton of money. Now people are going to say, well, I can take a parking space. I don't need a parking space. And if I can just finish, I'm sorry. So these edges on Stewart and Eddy, they are larger lots. And they have parking already. And they're already big buildings. And they're very attractive to graduate students to live in. And I don't think that this parking is going to just vanish there. The parking is going to change in the core when the property is very expensive, but on the flanking edges, there's less limitation to
the
traffic.
Part of the reason I mentioned parking, and I feel that we just mentioned something here, is that one of the reasons a lot of people that they don't go to College Town businesses is because there isn't parking for them to have access.
So there's an economic model basically for the parking. And it's going to be that the parking, say like street side meter parking, in the middle of College Town is going to cost you a respectable amount of money to park power. But as you get a 4-minute walk away from the center, it's going to go significantly down. And as you get farther away, it's going to go down even more. And the garage would be different. And the idea is that you make a 50% vacancy, and at the price that you're charging, people aren't going to want to park for 6 hours and you're charging them $1.50 an hour. They're going to park for a shorter period of time, but the price that encourages 50% vacancy. So then if I need to go to Stella to pick up something to have dinner, I can find a parking space. And I'm going to be there for an hour and a half. So I'm not going to, for the price of my dinner, $1 more, it's really not a huge incentive. So it was hot.
Okay, so I'm really sorry, but I'm going to hold the discussion there.
Please come up. So the goal here is I need input. I want to go to the city and tell them, if there's grad student enthusiasm, yes, grad students really would like to go to College Town. It's a phenomenal idea.
So quickly, at this point, as you probably know, the university and the city have both hired a consulting firm at an equal cost of $90,000. City $90,000, the university $90,000. Mr. Fuhr has already done. And now what needs to happen is the city needs to make the appropriate legislative decisions and actions. So now, with the master plan still progressing on campus and the campus life, master plan just initiated this semester, now the plan is approved in the fall. We think this is still very appropriate, even given the financial constraints and the university, restructuring priorities. And so what we're planning on doing is going to each of the assemblies and seeking support for the joint resolution, having the president sign on, obviously, and then giving this to the city. You know, a lot of development might not happen 5 to 10 years from now because of the financial condition, but the city now needs to make the appropriate legislation. So that's where we're at.
Okay. So I'm going to hold it there. Please do talk to these guys afterward. Like Ed said, he really wants to get your feedback, and he has direct contact. He goes to all of these meetings, so you can voice his opinions directly. But I know we have one more point of business, or at least a follow-up piece of business from a previous meeting, and so for that, I want to hand it over to Mike in the back.
I brought up an issue with 4 years ago regarding the addresses in the Cornell directory being easily accessible, visible, and you can go about suppressing it. And then this is an hour department of sociology where male graduate students handed in a paper to the personal address to females at 10 p.m. And so they just looked her up in the directory, so people are wondering how after you suppress that. So there is kind of a workaround that I wanted to share in case people are interested in doing it. And this basically involves, right now you're either suppress everything or nothing. So there's a way to do a partial suppression is that will work around. So in the Just Facts screen, if you go to the very bottom, this is personal information, and you click on select addresses. We have two addresses there, local and campus. And what you want to do is the system originally was designed for undergrads because they have, you know, their home address is basically their state home address, which the graduate students have their home address is our Ithaca address in most cases. So just when you change your local address to the home address, very importantly, in the home address, that's what actually shows up in the directory, put the letter R and just leave everything else blank. Very important, you don't delete it.
Put this in the home address?
Yeah.
Not the local address?
You put this in the local, you put the home address, your Ithaca address under the home address, and under the local address, you put the letter R. And this will signal to the system before it puts an R in the directory.
And this doesn't mess with anything in terms of like, getting your mail or
I've been fine so far. I didn't have any issues because your home address is still there. So when campus bodies pull your address, they have that available.
Okay.
You have to be capital.
Capital.
I think I have
capital. Capital R. Okay.
And right. What about telephone numbers? Is there a way to say have your email address but not your telephone number? Or
yes. So you could just not put your phone number. Sure. You just put your address at this point. You don't want your phone number shown to you.
Okay. So thank you, Mike, for following up on this. So this was something that he brought up at a previous meeting and looked into it, and we got an answer. So with that, are there any other points of new business to bring up? Seeing none, I'll ask for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
In a second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Meeting adjourned.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.